Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with painter Elizabeth Osborne. Her work is the subject of The Colour of Light, a new exhibition at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts opening Friday. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Hidden City Philadelphia Arts Festival. The month-long event brings performing and visual arts to historic architectural gems in the Philadelphia region. And Susan Lewis explores Winterthur Museum and Country Estate, the former home of collector and horticulturist Henry Francis DuPont. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Elizabeth Osborne was born, educated, and has spent almost all of her 72 years living and working in Philadelphia. She was educated at the University of Pennsylvania and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, where in 1961, at just age 25, she became the first female faculty member there in more than 40 years. Her work is featured in many prominent collections, including those of the Woodmere Art Museum, the Delaware Art Museum, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and of course at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, where an exhibition of approximately 50 paintings made between 1962 and 2009 opens on Friday. The exhibition, curated by Robert Cosolino, PAFA's Curator of Modern Art, is laid out thematically rather than chronologically and explores, in various sections, Osborne's figurative work, her interiors, nudes, landscapes and seascapes, as well as more abstract paintings in various media. The show is aptly called The Colour of Light, and besides a difficult period in her personal life in her 20s, represented by some darker images, Elizabeth Osborne's work is characterized by a love of and great skill in the use of vibrant colors. I met with Elizabeth Osborne at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts earlier this week. Is it fair to say that over the course of your career you have found different media, oil on canvas, acrylic, watercolor, and stuck with them for periods of time?
Yes, that's a good, very, very good observation. And it's true, I started with oils for a number of years. And in the early 70s, when acrylics, well, they actually were, a lot of artists like Frankenthaler and Olitsky were using acrylics on a large scale. And they had become quite, I don't want to say popular, but used. And it fascinated me, and I happened to have a student that I, at the academy where I was teaching, that was working in that technique, and I said, this is going to be an interesting, I wanted to get away from the oils and see what I could do with the acrylics. So I gave it a try and used it mostly, I did a figurative painting of Tony Greenwood, and then a number of reclining figures, nudes and otherwise, models, usually students. And then I did a series, quite a number of large landscapes based on certain site studies that I had made, either in mostly in Manchester, Massachusetts, and Maine, and some in the Southwest.
You were walked through this exhibition last evening by Robert Cosolino, and he explained to you why and how he had laid out the show. Happy?
Yeah, I think Bob did a great job because he sort of wanted to organize it, I think, in a way that was cohesive. In other words, starting off with the figurative works, which is where I really focused on in the 60s and part of the 70s, and then moving into the landscape and toward the end to more abstract works. It's not easy because there were different paintings. Some were acrylic, some were oil. So he, I think, really made a nice transition one from the other, and a very, very beautifully organized. And in his catalog, he has a lot more, of course, and more explanation of the work. But I think even just walking through, you get a sense of how I was progressing and sort of going from one period to the next. I mean, some artists are more I suppose I would say, even like you think of a Mirandi, who you see the, more or less a very similar subject throughout their career. But I tended to move through one period into an... it's my nature. I just like to challenge myself and try new things.
But they are thematic rather than chronological, but we did a little test here a few minutes ago where I was pointing at paintings and asking you to identify them, and you always seem to know what from what period of your career a painting was. Do you think that there have been very distinctive phases stylistically in your career?
Very much so. I think part of that, as I think with many artists, is an awareness of what other artists are doing and how they... certainly one period I know I was influenced by Diebenkorn, another period maybe by Frankenthaler or Morris Lewis, another period by a British artist, Howard Hodgkin, whom I admired a great deal. Or just what you see, you know, in exhibitions, and it's so easy to be aware of what's going on with the media. And I showed in New York for 10 or 15 years, so I was in and out all the time. And it seeps into you, and sometimes you'll see something and you say, gee, sort of resonates, and I'm going to see what I can do with that or what it will do for me in my work, a technique or a color or a scale of work. Yeah.
That said, though, and people will notice this in the exhibition, that there's a consistency of great energy and almost always the use of very vibrant colors.
Yes, and
You didn't have a dark period, really, did you?
Well, I did. I did, Jim. I had, you know, those... You just haven't... These are only two paintings out of... I don't know how many there were of that black. And actually, when I was at the Academy, all my work was gray and
brown.
As a student. And even when I got out of the Academy, for a few years... And I think my life was dark then. I had lost a twin sister, had lost my parents, I had a grandmother. It was like everybody was disappearing in my life. And I was a very dark period. And I think it affected my work. I really do.
Not heavily reflected in this show.
No. He only has a few of those paintings hanging. Yeah. But I, you know, you work through it, and I've started to, and I think all of a sudden I fell in love with the color, and it just started to emerge in my work, and
continues to this day.
It really does. It's very, I think, color and light are really driving forces in how I see things and what makes me want to go and put it down on canvas.
But you also seem to be quite an optimistic, quite a joyful person.
You think so? My daughter wouldn't say that. I don't think I am, but I think I, having had a lot of early challenges, I think, growing up, of not an easy childhood, that I learned to just move on, you know, just keep setting goals and moving forward, and that's what I do, and I think teaching has helped too in a funny way, where I only teach one day a week, but just working with young people and bouncing ideas back and forth has been a positive force in my life. Although I'm about to quit. I'm going to retire in about a year.
From teaching, not painting.
Yeah, from teaching. You know, I've done it long enough. It'll be 50 years in 2011. I'm going to leave then. Yeah, an adjustment, but I think it's time. Let some young artist in here in my place.
The work you're doing today is more abstract than had been the case in your early career. And you were at the Academy when there was, I think it's fair to say, almost an outright rejection of the ideas of abstract expressionism in this institution. Is that part of the reason that you're now looking at abstract expressionism? Because it was pretty much banned from your early education.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what, one of the turning points there as far as the Academy and abstraction, and you're right, we didn't have much exposure to it, even in the annual exhibitions. And then a couple years when I was out of school, I applied for a Fulbright and went to Paris and spent a year there. And, you know, I met artists there, and I became aware of what a more international view of what's happening in the United States with Jasper Johns and Rauschenberg, and all these artists were emerging as important pivotal figures in the American art, the art world. And all of a sudden I realized, wow, the Academy is, it was a good, basic, solid training, but there's a lot out there that I needed to learn about and that began to affect my work. John certainly did, and not Rauschenberg as much, although I loved looking at what he did.
But 45 years later, that was 45 years ago that you experienced those artists firsthand, and it would seem that it's only now that they're really becoming an effect, yeah.
Believe me, I've thought about it a lot, and I've owned four or five Hodgkin prints. I think he's a great, I love his work. A lot of people, I like a lot of abstract painters. He's not the only one, but I guess you just have to work through an idea or a period. But you're always kind of you, no matter what. You know, you're you. You just, it comes out in your work. You can't, I don't want to just pick up a magazine and say, oh, well, I'm going to become a photorealist. It's just crazy. I see students do that, and that's not the way I work. It takes time to work through ideas. And I think it takes kind of believing in who you are and yourself and just staying with it. I admire artists that do that because there's such long periods where you don't get recognition or you don't get money, you don't get a gallery, and you have to just keep... I really admire people that stay with it through all... And it's not as glamorous and easy as one might think. I guess that's true of any career, of course, not just painting. But anyway, you were asking if I was positive. I guess maybe I am. I'm certainly positive about my work and knowing that's what I want and what I love to do. There's just never been any question in my mind about that, ever. But... just getting your life set up so you can make that happen, you know. You're having to be able to pay the bills, to raise a family, to have a personal life. All those things have to be balanced in some way. It's always a struggle, I think, to do that.
Elizabeth Osborne, The Color of Light, the most comprehensive survey of her paintings to date, opens Friday in the Fisher Brooks Gallery on the first floor of the Samuel M. V. Hamilton Building at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts on North Broad Street in Philadelphia. Also opening Friday and running concurrently with the Osborne exhibition will be works by her friend and Academy colleague Sydney Goodman. The Man in the Mirror is at PAFA's Annenberg Gallery on the second floor of the Hamilton Building. Both shows run through September 20th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
This month, the inaugural Hidden City Arts Festival takes place in Philadelphia. It features a wide-ranging lineup of visual and performing arts in historic, often forgotten spaces. Now, as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the festival aims to spotlight both the art and the venues.
It's no secret that Philadelphia was once the American epicenter for commerce, science, government, arts, and culture. The city's importance during the colonial period is particularly well known, says Jay Wall, producer of the Hidden City Festival.
We tell the stories very, very well up until 1787. Constitution is ratified. Philadelphia is very prominent in that whole process, clearly. And then we sort of don't tell about Philadelphia's history past that.
But well after the 18th century, the region continued to play an important part in America's development, with a concentration of great wealth and influence. Evidence of this can be found throughout Philadelphia, with its multitude of historic and architectural gems. However, the history often lies buried in overlooked places, sometimes in crumbling, neglected buildings. Jay Wall says one of the goals of the Hidden City Festival is to help people rediscover these forgotten treasures.
All the historic assets of our city have all these rich stories that people aren't necessarily aware of. There's all these buildings people cannot get into or can get into on a limited basis or can always get into but don't know that they should.
Hidden City involves 9 different sites, including the German Society of Pennsylvania, Shiloh Baptist Church, the Royal Theater, and Founders Hall on the campus of Girard College. That majestic building's Greek Revival-style architecture with its enormous columns that are larger than those of the Parthenon cost about $2 million to build in the mid-1800s. That would be more than $50 million today. The structures at Girard College ranked among the most expensive in the United States prior to the Civil War, constructed in accordance with the will of Stephen Girard, a French-born Philadelphia businessman considered the wealthiest person in America when he died in 1831. Girard established his namesake school for the education of poor white orphan boys, though the school today is open to boys and girls of all ethnicities. While the first 2 floors of Founders Hall are still occasionally used today, the 3rd floor is typically closed off. The spaces that once served as the classroom for French, math, and natural history have been in disrepair for years. Green paint peels from the expansive walls, while the domed skylights are broken and clouded by dirt. Yet today, on this top floor, is the work of artist Steve Roden, sculptures, archives, and a sound installation, inspired by the building and Stephen Girard. While eerie recordings subtly drift through the halls, crates are scattered across the floor of one room, an homage to the countless crates of documents that Girard left behind. A colorful sculpture sits at the center of another room, built with pieces of wood that proportionally match the length of words from a phrase in Girard's will, "Nothing but what is therein contained." Works like this demonstrate another goal of Hidden City, to showcase high-quality art being made today in Philadelphia. Jay Wall says festival organizers were looking to create a symbiosis.
That we could use contemporary arts to tell the stories of these hidden treasures, and we could use these wonderful historic buildings and places and people to tell the stories of contemporary arts.
Featuring 10 different art projects, Hidden City's artistic executive director, Thaddeus Squire, says the festival is intended to explore many different facets of visual and performing art, but not without parameters.
We said one fundamental thing: you cannot just respond to the space physically. You have to go beyond that and deal with the history and the memory of the site. Now, how each artist does that or how that's accomplished is entirely up to the artist. And as you see in many of the projects, there are really diverse responses.
For instance, the Armory of the 1st Troop Philadelphia City Cavalry is hosting a co-production of the Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia and the Leah Stein Dance Company called Battle Hymns, with the music written by Pulitzer Prize-winning composer David Lang. The Mother Bethel AME Church in Center City, a famous stop on the Underground Railroad, features an exhibit that explores the secret language used by the Underground Railroad through quilts and celestial symbols. And the group Motion Dance Company will perform Revival at the Metropolitan Opera House on Philadelphia's North Broad Street. Incorporating about 20 chairs into a rehearsal of its new dance work, Revival very loosely plays off of the history of the Philadelphia Metropolitan Opera House and its many uses over the years. Built in 1908 by Oscar Hammerstein, the grandfather of the famous lyricist, This Met was once a fierce competitor to the Academy of Music, seating over 4,000 people in the Grand Hall. But the huge, ornate building proved difficult to keep viable, and over the decades it's changed hands many times, going from an opera house to a vaudeville stage to a sports arena to a church. The Holy Ghost Revival congregation today uses the lower half of the auditorium with a tarp overhead to shield it from dirt and any falling debris from the decaying ceilings. But even with the crumbling plaster and layers of dust, the top half of the auditorium still reflects the former glory of the structure, and the Group Motion Dance Company will perform here, spread out across the multiple tiers where seats were once bolted. Wally Cardona, the choreographer of Revival, says the Met is part of the dance piece. It's not some nondescript venue.
The dancers, as soon as they're moving down there, they have to deal with its precariousness. They have to deal with its actual structure. It's not a flat surface. These things are really integral to what they're doing. The picture is constant, and it's always, you know, for the viewer who's sitting here, it's always a part of the context. And for me, that picture, it includes, just by looking at it, layers and layers of history.
Fusing the history of the Hidden City sites with art is no easy task, according to festival director Thaddeus Squire. There's a good reason why a festival like this doesn't happen very often.
The name itself says it all. I mean, Hidden City is, it's very difficult to unhide that which is hidden on many levels. And so it's people, it's logistics, it's liability, it's everything. And it's to do this and to open these sites is an extraordinary operational undertaking and also a very expensive undertaking.
But Squire sees it as a worthwhile undertaking nonetheless, as involved organizations and the surrounding community hopefully become re-energized by the festival. Because, Squire says, Hidden City is not just about the past glory days of Philadelphia. It's also about the present and future of the city's many cultural treasures.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Group Motion Dance's production of Revival opens this Wednesday at the Philadelphia Metropolitan Opera House at 858 North Broad Street. And Battle Hymns, a co-production of the Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia and the Leah Stein Dance Company, is at the Armory of the 1st Troop Philadelphia City Cavalry this evening. The Hidden City Philadelphia Arts Festival runs through June 28th. The lush green foliage of the Brandywine Valley, dipping and rolling from southeastern Pennsylvania into northern Delaware, has attracted settlers for generations, among them the DuPont family, whose members have shaped much of the region's character with family holdings turned over to the community during the 20th century. Grounds of the Wilmington Country Club, the Methodist Country House Retirement Community, and Brandywine Creek State Park were all once owned by Henry Francis DuPont. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis visits Winterthur Museum and Country Estate, the home that this idiosyncratic collector of American decorative art designed and lived in as a museum in waiting.
Winterthur. The mammoth mansion filled with objects made or used in America between 1640 and 1860 started out simply as a 12-room family home. It was built in 1837 for Jacques-Antoine Bitterman and his wife, Evelina DuPont. They named it Winterthur after Bitterman's ancestral home in northern Switzerland. Before that, the property was a sheep farm owned by Evelina's father, E.I. DuPont, founder of the company that would make DuPont a household word. But even as a sheep farm, it had its celebrities, like sheep Don Pedro. Winterthur estate historian Maggie Litz says Don Pedro was in fact considered the father of the American Merino sheep.
Don Pedro was famous enough that when he died, Thomas Jefferson, who was then president, sent a letter of condolence.
Winterthur's agricultural focus continued when it became the home of Henry Algernon DuPont in 1875. He added a floor and a rectangular wing to the house, expanded the garden, and created a dairy herd, among other things. But it was under the stewardship of his son, Henry Francis, or H.F. DuPont, that Winterthur dramatically transformed from a family home to a historical showcase of unusual proportions. Over time, he would take what was a 40-room house and add on, and on, and on, as historian Maggie Litz describes.
H.F. DuPont made the house J-shaped. Today, there's 175 period rooms. There were kitchens in there, there were bathrooms, there were hallways. We count all of those today as our rooms because they're all public spaces.
But it didn't grow all at once. In 1916, H.F. became the manager of Winterthur Farms, which encompassed farmland, a dairy herd of Holsteins, and gardens, which he wanted to blend in with the surrounding landscape. Then, in the early 1920s, he took up collecting. One of the first things displayed to visitors taking a house tour is a pine dresser set out with pink patterned china. Linda Eaton, curator of textiles at Winterthur, says it was this piece, seen by DuPont during a visit to friends in Vermont, that started it all.
And he thought it was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen. And that got him started collecting American antiques, and Winterthur is the result.
As a collector, H.F. DuPont was voracious, says Maggie Litz. He bought not only objects like furniture, textiles, silver, brass, and pewter, he collected architecture. Maggie Litz says he sometimes even bought whole rooms. Whole rooms?
It's usually the architectural pieces. So it's the cornice around the ceiling, the mantle, the door, the window frames. The only time he could really install the entire room was when he was buying the whole house.
Incorporating whole houses into your design could conceivably present some decorating challenges. But while an ordinary collector might think about how something would fit into the house, DuPont sometimes redid the house to fit what he had collected. In 1948, DuPont turned his indoor badminton court into a courtyard and found a great way to use the exterior facades from buildings he'd purchased.
It's inside, but it feels like outside. There's cobblestones on the ground, and there are four different facades from different areas of the country and different periods. And what's most astonishing, I think, is one of them, the Red Lion Tavern from Delaware. You can walk inside, and in fact, the entire building is here.
Fabric was a decorating essential and something H.F. ravenously collected, says curator of textiles Linda Eaton.
He was coordinating the colors of the fabrics with the flower arrangements in the rooms.
And he used the colors in the room to bring the outside in.
He had seasonal changes in the period rooms to connect the colors in the house to the colors in his garden outside.
Outside, 60 of the now nearly 1,000 acres are intensively landscaped. Some formal gardens exist, but there are many areas deliberately planned to enhance the natural beauty of the landscape, says Winterthur's director of garden and estate, Chris Strand.
He romanticized the landscape here, and he loved the rural architecture, the barns and everything that we had, and he loved those views out over the meadows, seeing farm fields, and even the way the roads are designed. I mean, they're very artfully done, and it was part of the whole experience here.
Today, the staff continues to maintain this naturalistic feel and has made minimal changes, except to limit invasive plants and accommodate visitors to the estate. The enchanted garden, created at the site of the old swing set, is an example.
One of the things we have with a place that's this old is we have lots of things that have gotten discarded. And so they began to assemble this garden out of pieces of the estate. And the story that they used to sort of bind it all together was to say that the fairies who inhabited this garden built this garden so that they could bring the children back that used to play here.
Today's visitors can see the period rooms of the house through guided tours, browse through a library, take tram rides through the gardens, or wander through the newer wing of galleries opened in 1992 to show objects that literally don't fit in the house. The galleries also house special exhibitions. Among the objects at Winterthur are many quilts. A patchwork quilt is perhaps an apt metaphor for Henry Francis DuPont's collection and the way it evolved piece by piece. Beautiful objects in themselves, yet connected to one another, to the environment, and to the human lives they touched. Maggie Litz says DuPont left a magnificent story.
This is his autobiography. It's not written, it's built.
An historic mansion, art galleries, and meticulously planned gardens celebrating the natural landscape. Perhaps most of all, Winterthur is a view of the world seen through the eyes of one intellectually curious man, who had the resources to indulge his creativity in an extraordinary way, and then turn it over to us.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Today until 3, Winterthur celebrates the beginning of summer with music and activities for children and families in its enchanted woods. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony in C under Rosson Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.